I'm Christopher Lydon. Under the spell, I think, of the young writer Rana Dasgupta from England and India, in the strangeness of his new novel Solo, I think he's trying to show us a way out of the last century of trains and science and wars and ideology into the very different connectivity and culture of our stubborn old humanity. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Rana Dasgupta, I'm still trying to figure out who you are. I see you as an artist and something of a prophet. You're Salman Rushdie's idea of the most unexpected and original Indian writer of your generation. Surely you're another one of those novelists like Rushdie or Ishiguro or Garcia Marquez, perhaps, aiming to introduce not just your place in the world, but to some universal space where people all over the world are looking for clues and understanding and meaning. The space you chose to tell your story from is Bulgaria, about which most of us know nothing. Why Bulgaria?
Well, Bulgaria was a country that I was drawn to for various reasons, even long before I thought I would write a novel about it. I was interested initially in some music that I heard that came out of that place, music so exotic and remote that I felt I wanted to find out what had produced it, where it had come from. So I began a kind of Bulgarian investigation. I went looking through history and reading about the place. And at the time that I started becoming interested in it was also the time where there was a huge kind of economic collapse in the mid-90s in Bulgaria. And Bulgaria was in the newspapers a fair amount. There were stories of middle classes rifling through garbage bins because they couldn't feed themselves anymore. There was a lot of political desperation. And it was one of those many stories of that part of the world, of the shock of the end of communism and the kind of harsh realities that people were being introduced into at that time. And old people were particularly hard hit because welfare systems completely disappeared. And even now, when you go to that part of the world, you see a lot of old people sitting in doorways trying to eke out some existence in their old age. And so when I started looking into Bulgarian history, starting from the beginning of the 20th century, I realized that here we had an incredible tale, which was a kind of parable of the global 20th century, because Bulgaria had started as part of an empire, the Ottoman Empire. Mm. It had found its independence as a European monarchy with democratic systems, which had changed because of the internal conflicts in the country into a fascist dictatorship. It had started the Second World War on the side of the Germans, allied with Hitler, had switched sides in the middle of the war when the Soviet Union invaded and took over Bulgaria, had been a communist dictatorship for 45 years until 1989, and then became embroiled in this kind of chaotic casino capitalism, which is still trying to work itself out. So all the big ideas of the 20th century were somehow present there, had been tried there, and it seemed like the accumulation of all these ideas had actually been a kind of melancholy reduction of the place and its spirit. The place had started the 20th century with a lot of ambition, a lot of optimism, a feeling that it was possible to do anything in modern times, that one could build here in this place another Vienna, another Berlin, another Paris.
On the railroad between Berlin and Baghdad, right?
The character in my story is involved, his father is involved with the railways, he's building that railroad that you're talking about, which for me was another kind of sign of that early 20th century optimism of places being interconnected. The idea of a railway line from Berlin to Baghdad at the time that I was writing the book, which was when Baghdad was in the state that we can imagine, was kind of incredibly romantic to me. This idea of proximity, of that one could have European, Europe could have a rather intimate relationship with Baghdad. You could just get on a train and go there. Now it seems much further away in a in an age that we call globalization. Places seem less connected, less intimate in some ways.
The man preaching the railroad in your book, it sounds like he's hyping the internet. This will take you out of your village. It will move you faster than you've ever moved before.
Well, the technological euphoria that we see in the railways is something that kind of plays itself out through the novel as, and takes always a melancholy turn, because technology can never, what happens to the railways he's building across that part of the world is that they get ripped up by the First World War, and that interconnectivity is never rediscovered. And so it becomes clear that technology is always subordinate to human history, to politics. Its promise can always be taken away by human events. And so I designed a character in a way who would span this entire 100-year history in order to give us a sense of what we had lived through in the 20th century and what it meant. And I think choosing Bulgaria as a place to start was a choice of a place that was neither catastrophically bad nor kind of triumphantly good in its experience of the 20th century. It was just a rather incidental place that had been kind of moved across by lots of armies, bombed by Britain and America, occupied by the Soviet Union, inflamed by lots of kind of political currents that kind of ripped it apart, and in a way just sort of laid waste in a rather ordinary kind of way, so that the feeling at the end of the 20th century seemed to be one of kind of loss and melancholy and a certain sort of silence over what had happened, an inability to express really what all this had meant. And I found this to be a kind of moving and poignant place in which to set a reflection on this century that we that recently ended. And indeed, as you said in your introduction, a reflection on what it might mean to construct a culture of the century to come.
Ulrich, this old man, 100 years old as he reviews his life, was a child of borders, as you say, and literally railroad tracks, but he's a scientist, he's a chemical engineer, working under a communist system. Both communism and science sort of literally blow up in his face. He's blinded by, in his own factory. And here we are in a new century, groping for a different direction. That applies to all of us. How would you describe this new setting?
One of the things I'm trying to do in this book is to complexify a very facile perspective on our times, which is essentially a metropolitan and elite perspective, which is that everyone moves, everyone's in touch. It's not quite true. Air travel, visas, all these kinds of things are problematic for a lot of people in the world, which is why in the sort of hidden columns of our newspapers, we're always seeing people dying at borders, trying to get through, hanging onto the bottom of aircraft, sinking in ships that are trying to cross the Mediterranean, things like that. We are in this moment where there are lots of people who are being pushed out of a place or attracted to another place and can never actually make it. The novel is split into two halves, and the first half is the life of this man, Ulrich, and the second half is his daydreams. His daydreams are a kind of a set of fantasies which include all the unexpressed residue of his life, his frustrated life, a life where horizons have shrunk and possibilities have been denied him. And in those fantasies, we see a bunch of young characters who are entering into the 21st century with very, very different set of ambitions and perspectives that he had. They are feeling that the world is possibly opening up again, that they have opportunities that they are the first generation for a long time to have. And because of that history of destitution, of turbulence, of poverty, of just cynical denial of possibilities to people, they are entering that situation with enormous energy and ambition. So one of the characters in particular in that second half, who comes out of the Republic of Georgia, she is propelled by enormous personal experience of political turbulence and loss into the global market like a bullet. She wants to really achieve something there at all costs, to achieve her own financial stability, the financial stability of her family, and nothing is going to stop her. And she becomes a formidable, terrifying character. She ends up in New York. In New York, she becomes very successful in this dynamic company she joins, and she's sitting around the boardroom table as a young woman with a bunch of other people who are running this company, and none of them, I think, have a sense of just how ballistic is the energy in this woman, because she has been shot out of the gun of the Republic of Georgia. And my sense is that, living in India as I do, my sense is that this is actually the situation of an enormous number of young people across the globe. India is an incredibly young place. And since India joined the global economy, which was in 1991, at approximately the same time that Eastern Europe joined the global economy, a whole generation has reached adulthood. A very, very large number of people has reached adulthood. And those people are entirely unwilling to live the kind of lives that their parents lived. And as I say, I think it's difficult for a lot of people in Western Europe and America to imagine with just how high the stakes are for all those people who are coming into that situation.
The other unforgettable young character in the second part of the book is a violinist named Boris. He's been basically practicing his violin for years with pigs, but he arrives like another rocket in the global music market and New York. He is a kind of Orpheus character, beyond the beyond's beauty, rapture, mystery in his music. This is genius world music from a gypsy without a nation. What is that telling us?
Well, the main character, Ulrich, who's having the daydream of this young man, is somebody to whom music has been denied. And as he's gone through his life in silence, both because his father smashed his violin and said he would never play it again because he didn't want him to be a musician, but also because the Bulgarian state banned much of the music that he had grown up with, he went through various kinds of musical silence, which meant that music for him swelled and swelled until it represented everything that was good and denied to him. And this character that he daydreams is the image of that other plenitude of music. And he grows up in a town that is devastated by the end of the Soviet Union, and town that everyone leaves except his grandmother and him, and then his grandmother dies, and he is there playing his violin in an abandoned chemical factory with, as you say, only the pigs for company. And he turns up in New York by a set of mysterious circumstances and becomes this huge star here. And I think that he comes into a world that has become quite cynical, and that is the world of world music, a world of industrial culture which has sort of exhausted itself and is looking desperately around the world for new things, new sounds that can come in and rejuvenate it. And Boris has something, has some genius, some amazing relationship to his art that electrifies that industry for a while. But Boris himself never feels contained by it, and the end drifts away from it and disappears at the very end of the book. I think the other work that music is doing in this book is, the book itself is an attempt to think about what global culture would be like. And Boris is a sort of person in the novel that's also on that search, which is not to say a culture without any roots, without any human feeling to it. It's not some sort of digital abstract culture. It is a highly felt culture, which in a way tries to precisely restore the human perspective, the human duration, into this thing that we call globalization. I think, personally, I have ambiguous feelings about globalization. I'm for anyone writing novels, anyone trying to produce innovation, new things in culture, the trap of nostalgia is one doesn't want to fall into. One has to be concerned with the future, preoccupied by the future, trying to put into the world something that will help us imagine better futures. And for me, writing books is, at this stage in history, like making any kind of art, is really about helping us to see the future as a viable place, a place where we can unfurl ourselves as a species and continue to live with the levels of dignity and creativity that we always have. So I would want my work and I would want my life, in a sense, to be hyper-modern, to be absolutely in this moment that we are living, absolutely conscious of it and aware of it, but at the same time to be highly cynical of it and to be deeply in touch with the eternal human story, never to lose sight of the myths, the enormous human resources that have got us this far. So I think I guess I would be just highly ambivalent, really. I would be fully, try to remain fully conscious of the enormous catastrophe that we are living through, but never to play down either the enormous excitement and euphoria that modern life offers of moving through time with this level of change and innovation.
Including Boris's music, out of the pig pen, so to speak, out of his own imagination, out of his own enormous drive.
Yeah, I think that one of the things I feel about globalization is that it describes processes that are primarily electronic and commercial in nature. It is really capital that is the mobile thing. And since we are now in this world where we are very interconnected in various kinds of ways, in ways that are conscious to us because we are in touch with people in lots of places on the planet, but also ways that we're not so conscious of. Our waste moves around the world. Our products are made all around the world. We are deeply invested in the planet as a single space. I think that we need to be creating culture that is of this space as well. I think the
culture moves pretty well. It's migrants and people that scare the wits out of Europe or the States or lots of places.
Yeah, I think one does also have to think about when one's writing a novel or making a film, who are the people who can speak for this system? Very, very often, the people who are most visible to us are the people who are the aristocracy of this system, the people who have this kind of effortless movement around it, who celebrate its values, and often who live in places that give them the sense that this system is a rather serene system. They're kind of in the idylls of global capitalism. And in such places, one feels that there's enormous continuity with the past, that the physical environment is rather serene and unchanging, and shops deliver to you all the great bounty of the world. There are libraries and bookshops, and one feels in touch with the intellectual life of the world. What could be wrong with this system, if that is your experience of it? Of course, that's not the only experience of it. At the rock face of it, this system feels like the most destructive system ever to exist. And that turbulence is something that is the kind of weak point of this system. It finds it very difficult to really acknowledge that thing. And my novel is to some extent about that it's about entropy. It's about the feeling that the creation of order such as I've just described, always creates a greater amount of disorder around it. And the people who live in the midst of that disorder, the people who feel themselves to be part of that disorder, it's a very, very different kind of world.
Mm.
What one should not take away from this is, I think, some kind of opposition to the great achievements of modernity. I don't think we should stop doing a lot of the things that we do. That's not the point. It is just to say that the world is more tragic than we acknowledge to ourselves, and there are consequences and there is fallout from a lot of these processes that we also have to acknowledge. And if we're to have a truer picture of how all these things fit together, if we're going to stop being surprised by the fact that there are people who have very violent reaction to the world that we're living in, we have to just take into account some of these processes and how they play out.
In a conversation maybe a year ago, you remarked to me, Rana, that you thought that what seems like the eternal war of the Congo might be one of the most instructive stories on our planet today. Do you still think so? And how would you describe the lure and the cosmic meaning of that story?
Well, everything is present in that story. Everything that we are today is present in that story. Mm. From the 19th century, if you look at the immense cynicism with which that place has been treated, not least of course by King Leopold of Belgium, who might have been responsible directly for killing 10 million people. In the name of rubber, which was the first crop, the first big product of Congo was rubber. And he basically enslaved the entire population to produce it and punished them in horrifying ways if they didn't fulfill quotas. And the story of how that story came out is one of the really shining currents of the 20th century, which is the current of activism and reportage and speaking back to evil and defending human rights by people who are not directly themselves implicated in the situation. I think the story of the entire 20th century in that place has been the curse of wealth and what it means to be sitting on natural resources that other people have intense stakes in. But I think where that story becomes very urgent for us is the fact that people like King Leopold do not even feature in the lists of tyrants of the 20th century. We have Stalin, we have Hitler, we have Pol Pot, we have these kind of figures who were constantly trotted out as the people who represented the dark face of the 20th century. But we at the end of the beginning of the 21st century, when Stalin and Pol Pot and people like that, even Hitler to some extent, have become much less politically significant to us, should be remembering King Leopold, who is a capitalist tyrant, who is part of the system that we are part of, who represented the worst face of our own impulses. And that's why that story is relevant and terrifying for us.
Mm. Speaking of a changing world, I mean, we speak this moment in the distant glow of an uprising in Egypt that may turn out to be a world historical event. This flood of human energy runs through your book in a strange way. Most of it is underground and unseen. Ulrich has a rather dull life, and it ends in a kind of failure, and yet he can conjure in his fantasies these artists of enormous power in poetry and music, etc. Is it he or another character who says the life we live is only a fragment, really, of who we are? The light that we thought was Egypt a month ago is something vastly more powerful today.
These things, moments of the population rising up into the streets, that is a fantasy that many of us hold always. We have that image. What would it be like if suddenly this happened? And the fact that it's happening in Egypt and the fact that the world is so transfixed by it is partly because we all have that. It's a kind of almost primordial urge to just sweep away everything that is there with this erotic energy of the multitude that it can just... And Yes, for the most part, that energy is never expressed. It is only in remarkable moments that this energy becomes real. And I think that is part of Ulrich's story, that his situation is that his energy is never expressed. In very, very rarely in his life does he come to that moment where energy can be externalized. And the fact that he is so full of fantasies and daydreams is precisely that.
He's consoled at the end of his own life by the thought that this is part of the game. He had known Albert Einstein in Berlin in his youth, and he retranslates to himself something Einstein had said to him. He said, in effect, I need you to be me. The world requires your failure in a certain sense to produce my genius or something.
Yes, Ulrich comes to some kind of, I suppose, some sort of cosmic understanding of his own place in the system. I think he says that he was on the debit side of the century. He creates a kind of logical circle between himself and Einstein, which is to say that somehow Einstein's meteoric success and his failure were one and the same. They were linked together in some kind of mystical system. And he has some evidence for that. And he realizes that Einstein's life, though Einstein had incredible scientific breakthroughs and was an incredible figure of the 20th century, there was an incredible devastation in his private life. His son, who was schizophrenic and spent most of his life in an insane asylum outside Zurich, his abandoned first wife, who was very much part of his 1905 discoveries, who he left in poverty. And Ulrich reflects on the relationship between, which he doesn't feel is incidental, between this kind of burning light of Einstein's success and the kind of ashes all around him. And it becomes for him an allegory of his own place in the world, because Bulgaria is also a kind of carbonized place that has been sort of not really incinerated, but kind of lightly burned by the 20th century, or slow burn of the 20th century, where not much is left afterwards. And that's how he comes to some understanding of his situation.
What is the Rana Dasgupta story within this story? Child of an Indian father, English mother, born and educated in England. As I understand it, you followed your girlfriend, now your wife, to India, where you've lived for 10 years. What is that story of a man of European and Indian and universal culture inventing these moral stories that are so fascinating?
I don't think I'm not a person of universal culture. I'm a person of very specific cultures. And well, I have a Bengali father who left India when he was in his 20s and went to England. And he married an English woman, and I grew up in England with really a very conventional English upbringing, except that my family would go to Calcutta every few years, and we would spend 2 or 3 weeks there. And I would have this completely different alternative life for a few weeks every couple of years, which I didn't really discuss with my friends, because I didn't really think that they would have any sense. I lived in a very, very white English kind of environment. So I always grew up, I think, with this sense that there were always secret stories to one's reality. There were always more stories. The official story was important, but it was not big enough or complex enough to contain one's entire reality. One's entire reality always escaped the official stories. And so I think I've grown up with a fascination for the untold stories, for the stories that lie behind our reality, a feeling that that reality conceals as much as it shows. So I don't feel that I have anything about me that is universal, but I do have an enormous curiosity for those untold stories. And in deciding to write this novel about Bulgaria, for instance, which is a place that I have, in a sense, no right to write about, I felt that I would sort of act on this impulse and try and write about a place that I really knew nothing about. Mm. Because it felt to me that in a way to write about that which one didn't know was a truer response to the planetary situation than to write about that which one does know. Because what one knows is actually is much more insignificant than what one doesn't know. Writing about what one knows, in a way, is to reproduce again what already exists in some kind of way. Mm. To tell one's own story, especially if it's a national story or an ethnic story, is to sort of, in my own writing and in my own life, it felt like it could turn into self-satisfaction, some kind of constant rehashing of something that one already knew. And I wanted to see if it was possible to write about things that one didn't know and to see what kind of unpredictable effects that would create. And I think that in my own life, the unpredictable effects it created was that I felt that I took on Bulgarian history as my own in some sense. And I feel like I am deeply implicated in that place. Its history affects me. I read things about that country in the same way as I read things about my own country. They expand my sense of who I am. And I have a love for that place, which has arisen from the 4 or 5 years that I worked on this novel and built around myself a network of Bulgarian friends who would help me with it. And the novel, when I went to Bulgaria to launch it, also created extraordinary effects. There was the sense that the strange, haunted psychological effects that the novel was about, which had arisen precisely from the continual ruptures, political ruptures of the 20th century, where one was continually cut off from what one had been before and had to reconstitute oneself. And there was that was a subject that was very, very much our discussion in Bulgaria. And the question of how one gets beyond it and kind of moves forward into a new century where a lot of those things are no longer really relevant.
What would you hope for your daughter's culture to be growing up with a half English daddy in New Delhi when she's 17, when she's 30?
My daughter is now, she's 4 in 2 days.
So happy birthday.
She's very small. I certainly, we're in the midst of sending her to school, so all these things are very, very present for us right now. We want her to, of course, have access to all the greatest currents of human learning and culture, which means not only those from the West, but also from the place that she lives in, for instance, India. And I feel that that Indian myth, Greek myth, all these kinds of things, which we're just getting into now, are as good now as they always were at giving you a sense of the wonder and beauty and terror of life.
When will your daughter be introduced to the Ramayana?
That's already happened. In fact, we were having dinner one day recently, and my wife, Monica, told her the whole story, or told me and her the whole story, and we spent about 2 hours.
The Ramayana over supper, wow.
Yes, Monica's very good at this. She knows it very well, and she told the story from beginning to end, and it was electrifying. It's not something we do generally. It was an unusual evening, but it was fantastic to remember what pleasure it is to eat and be told a story. And Amalia, who, as I say, is not yet 4 years old, was never let Monica's attention wander whenever the story got interrupted. What happened next? What happened next?
So, what's the hardest bad news of the Ramayana for a 4-year-old child, or for any of us?
Well, in a way, the end of the book is terrible, because Sita, who has been the virtuous wife and has waited for her husband Ram all this time, when finally everything goes right and he marches back and gets his crown, his throne, and they become king and queen again, he begins to distrust that his wife has remained faithful to him and forces her to go through all kinds of terrible tests. And eventually, at the very end, she is again evicted into the forest, and the earth swallows her up. And one of the discussions that one has to have, I think, with a daughter, is a feminist discussion about a lot of these things. How will you, as a girl, read these stories and feel that you can inhabit them freely with a sense of your own potential?
Hmm. What would your hope be for the culture of a new interconnected global landscape with all this human energy kind of a keystroke away?
I think it's important for us to live at several levels and several scales. To inhabit globalization can seem like to look at the planet from the position of mobile money. And that is a position without body, without time. And what disappears in that perspective is some kind of real bodily existence in which the body decays and dies. And the fact that human life has a duration, that it arcs and should be thought about not as infinite digital time, but as human time, is something we also have to hold on to in this age of globalization, because without that perspective, then everything disappears. So that's why I think I feel there is a marriage in my own work between two sort of opposite ends of the spectrum, one being this absolutely intoxicating world of information and culture, which we are right to be excited about, which gives us access to all kinds of human experiences, and we can label some kind of global digital euphoria, whatever you might want to call it. But at the other end, to stress and to value the folkloric, that body of human culture that has tied us to certain places, tied us to the land, tied us to seasons, tied us to a sense of mythic concerns. And mythic concerns are essentially those things that make us human: love and cruelty and death and fertility and all those things that remind us essentially that we are the same species as all those other people who've lived before us. And none of this digital information or whatever can fundamentally change the nature of the questions that we have to ask ourselves. And that if the horizons on which we're asking those questions are massively expanded, and that the forms of life with which we are compelled to identify and empathize are perhaps radically more different and varied than in previous ages, the reason why we would be interested in those people and the nature of the challenges that we have to solve with those people is still ultimately informed by the same basic sense of life.
Rana Dasgupta, people, including me, celebrate the originality, often the strangeness, of this novel, Solo. I want to thank you for the originality and approachability of this conversation. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.